from the NBC News Radio Broadcasting Studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful Southern California. And it was a nice day today. And in parallel, we'll Turfs Up Radio Studio. Turfs Up Radio is the only radio station dedicated to the green industry, and you can check us out on that website. You doing lip syncing?
Yes.
I was watching Chris. You make me laugh. I can't stop laughing when I do. I can't be serious when you're here. So leave. No, just kidding. Welcome back. I heard you had a short little 3-day vacation.
Yeah, did. Went wetted a line up there.
So you yes, forgot, I did. You Thank you very much.
Forgot to turn the mic on.
I did. We went and wetted a line. We did some fishing up in the Eastern Sierras.
Excellent. Had a nice time. I saw the pictures. They look beautiful.
Yeah, that's good. But actually, brought home some trout and some honey.
So you guys, you brought honey for the honey?
Yes, I did. Absolutely.
she'll like that. And thank you for the jar today.
You're welcome.
That was great. I'm going to have that tonight.
My pleasure.
Appreciate that. Hey, just for our listening audience, those who are in the landscaping or irrigation business or just a DIY person, the 2019 Irrigation Show and Education Week is heading to Las Vegas from December 2nd to the 6th. Irrigation professionals will gather from all over the world to preview the industry's latest products, technologies, and innovation. We're going to be there as well.
We are indeed.
Broadcasting live every day. This year's show offers new industry insights, sessions discussing the latest trends and today's relevant topics, as well as valuable professional network opportunities. They can come talk to us all in one great location. That's at the Convention Center. So whether you work in agriculture, landscape, golf, sports, turf, or nursery, or just a homeowner, the 2019 Irrigation Show has something for you. Learn more at www.irrigationshow.org and register by November 1st to take advantage of early bird rates. And it's a great show. They got over 10,000 people coming.
Yeah, it's a huge show, right? And it just everything from A to Z, soup to nuts. If it's irrigation, it's in Las Vegas, December 3rd through 6th.
And remember what happens in Las Vegas?
Stays in Las Vegas.
Anyway, we're glad to have everybody in, and it's a good week. I'm glad you're back. Glad you're safe.
Thanks.
Glad you didn't fall in the water and drown. And
didn't say I didn't do that.
Oh, you mean that little 1-pound fish pulled you into the water?
Yeah, well, let's say the slippery bank pulled me into the water.
Oh, okay.
More than once.
Now, did you do fly fishing or just regular?
No, not this time. We didn't. We fished mostly the streams and the lakes in the Eastern Sierra from Lone Pine up until Mammoth.
I got to do that. I got to take my grandson for a couple of days and go do that.
It's a lot of fun.
I know. I haven't done it in 30 years. So
we did a lot of fishing and we did a little catching.
Cool. That's the only way to do it. Well, let's bring on our wonderful guest who's not really a guest anymore. She's really part of the show.
Absolutely is.
And we love her to death. She's the purveyor of Maven's Notebook, and her name is Miss Chris Austin. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Splendid today. Thanks very much. I'm going to start off because, you know, the first thing I saw on Maven's Notebook on the notes when I tuned in today as my first day back.
A fish story.
So Chinook salmon, it says Chinook salmon flocking to a revitalized San Joaquin River. So the first comment I'll make is I didn't know fish flocked. I thought they schooled. But then again, you know, I don't write this stuff, so.
Yeah, what can you say for headlines? I am headline challenged, so, you know, what can I say? It's not my headline.
No.
Yeah, it's actually kind of amazing. They've tried to put some salmon back in the San Joaquin River. This is a river that is actually dry for, like, 60 miles, but the NRDC had a lawsuit and won that they had to restore salmon to the San Joaquin River. So they actually did that. They, you know, they chose a hatchery that had salmon and used that as sort of a breed stock to plant the salmon in the river, and they came back. So in large numbers. So. You know, they're very happy about that. The problem, I think, that people see is, you know, with climate change and the warming temperatures, these southern rivers like the San Joaquin, you know, how viable is it going to be for, you know, salmon to survive in that? Because the one factor that we, the humans, can't manipulate is the temperature of the water. Well, we can to a certain extent if we have cold water in the dam and we can release the water at the lower levels from the dam where the temperature is cooler. But by and large, you know, the air temperature is hot, then the water temperature is going to be warm also, and there's not a whole lot we can do about that. Although in Oregon, they've really tried to do this with chillers and bubblers and things like that.
Right.
But, you know, I think sometimes we have to be realistic about what we can do to save species in the face of climate change, because there's only so much we can do. So
is that portion of the San Joaquin River where they reintroduced that salmon, is that a managed flow portion of the, because you said it was dry.
It was dry for a while. Previously dry. They've actually been sending water down the river from the dam. They, you know, the farmers and those that held the water rights were actually had to give up, some would say forced, you know, court ruling, to give up some water to flow down the river. And there's been a lot of issues with that. You know, the channel, the river channel had been dry for 50, 60 plus years. And so, you know, cleaning it out, getting it ready for water to flow down, and then there was a lot of seepage concerns and, you know, underground flooding in surrounding farm fields. And there, so it hasn't been an easy ride.
So does this mean?
But it has been successful for the salmon. So that's the good news. That was sort of the goal, you know, to get the salmon back.
So does that mean when Chris goes fishing for salmon, he's going to get pre-cooked?
Usually it's when they're young is when they get cooked, when they're too small to be kept.
I see they're getting the hook for me right now. Get out. So what's the biggest story this week?
Well, the biggest story, I guess you would say, is that the State Water Board yesterday approved a salt and nitrate management plan for the Central Valley.
All right, about time.
Yeah, you know, salinity in irrigated agriculture is really a factor almost universally, especially in arid lands. You know, like in the Imperial Valley, they have a lot of salinity issues because there's just a lot of salt in the soil anyways, and then they irrigate it with, you know, flow from the Colorado River, which is also salty, and so they dump all their irrigation runoff into the Salton Sea, which is sort of a saline water body, so that's sort of how they deal with it. In the Central Valley, there are a lot of evaporation ponds and other things around, but you know, salinity in agriculture is a big issue. I mean, it brought the ancient civilization of Mesopotamia down because all their soil got, you know, salinified, and when you get that salt in the soil, then the plants don't grow.
That's
a problem, and it caused the end of that civilization. So solving the salt issue and the salt balance issue. I mean, there's even salt balance. That's something that the water agencies here in Southern California pay attention to. We don't really talk about it. We as regular people don't know about this, but this is part of the many services that and things that people, you know, much smarter about these things than us worry about and have, you know, taken care
right,
of.
Right.
You know. But it's a huge issue. So they've approved this plan. It was not without controversy.
Sure.
They've actually been working on this plan for over a decade. It's a salt plan, you know, because all these imported waters and, you know, they're bringing in salt. All water has salt to a certain extent. And the salt comes in and it evaporates, and the water evaporates, but the salt remains.
Right.
So you bring in more water, it evaporates, more salt, and that's really, you know, the big issue.
Yep, the water is used, but the salt stays, right? So, yeah.
Right, exactly. And nitrate is another problem. Nitrate is related in a sense, but nitrate is generally from the application of fertilizers. in the field that leaches into the groundwater, and too much nitrate in someone's drinking water supply is the problem. You know, so, the problem, the overlying issue, I guess, is that in the Central Valley, in these towns, you know, agriculture is their economy. And if you say to agriculture, you cannot do what you are doing because you're polluting the groundwater, so the farmers stop farming, then the economy of these small towns really falls down. So the State Water Board has really tried to balance this issue. And so they have given a timeline for the farmers to figure out how to clean up the nitrogen and clean up the salt and improve the quality in the groundwater aquifers. But that timeline that they approved is like 35 years.
That's a long time. That's a long time.
That's a long time. But these, you know, on the flip side, these issues, they are not easily solved. Because if they were, we would have already done that.
Yeah.
Let's get real here.
Yeah.
So,
yep.
you know, the State Water Board has tried to balance, you know, clean drinking water and agriculture, which sustains the economies of these cities. So they have required the agricultural dischargers and anybody who's discharging anything that has salt or nitrate in it in the area, they require them now to provide safe drinking water for anybody who's using water in that area. And there was a lot of controversy about that and how they would calculate and how they would cover people. This involved bringing people bottled water or installing a filter on their sink where they drink and where they, you know, the kitchen sink. Or it could be having clean drinking water fill stations that people can drive to and get it.
That's good water.
But in some way, they have to provide clean drinking water for those that are affected. And in some of these basins, we are talking thousands of people who have domestic wells that are impacted by these contaminants.
Hey, Chris, we're going to have to wrap up because we got a shorter session with you tonight. And so I think salmon and salt are probably going to be the two things that we talk about on this show.
We have an extended recorded interview that we got in this afternoon, so we got to get to that. But what we're going to do is not do this again next time, so we'll give you half the show.
Oh, that's okay. We
want you to be on it. So we're just short on time. So anyway, anybody listening, go to mavensnotebook.com, be a sponsor, get her stuff every single day. It's the best place to get water news. That makes me smarter every day because I know what she knows now.
And me smarter as well.
That's right.
Hey, Chris, have a great rest of your day.
You too. Good evening, guys.
Good evening.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, we're lucky this afternoon to have three nice people from the Riverside County Flood Control and Water Conservation District. And we have Ms. Darcy Kunze, who's the Government Affairs Officer, Mr. Jason Yulee, who's General Manager and Chief Engineer, and Mr. Richard Boone, who's Chief of Watershed Protection. So for our listeners, I know a lot of people talk about floods and they hear this on the news and everything, but what exactly, for our listeners, does the Riverside County Flood Control District do, and who do they report to?
All right, great. Well, first, thank you for taking the time to have us on your show. We're really honored to be here today. And as far as what our agency does and our purpose, our job is really to manage rainwater runoff, or stormwater runoff, as it's called sometimes. And so when it rains, the water hits your yard, the water hits the streets, it starts to wash off into our communities and into our lakes, rivers, and streams. That's the water that we manage. And so when we manage stormwater, we really try to do it for three different purposes. We do it first to ensure our communities are safe. And so when we're performing that role, we're focused on our flood control mission. We're focused on building dams, storm drains, channels, levees that help ensure that our communities are safe from flooding. The second purpose we manage stormwater for is for sustainable communities. And so when we're managing stormwater for sustainability, we're focused on trying to capture some of that stormwater and basically infiltrate it into the ground, into our local aquifers, so that it's available to our local water districts and it offsets the need for imported water supplies down the road. And then the last reason, and we also do it for environmental purposes, to protect the health and safety of our lakes, rivers, and streams. The last reason we manage stormwater is to promote livable communities. And this is a part of our mission that we've kind of been more focused on recently. And it's a recognition that even though our mission is really solely focused on managing stormwater, we really exist in a broader community, and the community has broader needs. And so we try now to focus on working with our sister agencies to make sure that when we build a project, it not only serves the stormwater purpose, but it serves other needs of the community as well, so that we end up with a better community, a more livable community down the road. And so an example of this might be we have basins that we build to store stormwater. Normally only rains 10 days a year in Riverside County. If we could, the other 355 days of the year, those basins are dry. Well, what if we could make that basin into a park? What if we could make it into ball fields? What if we could turn our trails or our channel access roads into trails so that the land's serving two or three different purposes? And so when we focus on the livability of our community, that's really what we're trying to do, is to work with our sister agencies to make sure that at the end of the day, we're getting the most value we can out of our tax dollars by partnering with them.
And so, wow, that was a jam-packed summary, Jason. I appreciate that.
So sorry.
Let me ask another question kind of following on to that, right? As you say, you work with your sister agencies to meet some of the other needs of the community. I would imagine one of those, if not probably one of the more important ones, is contributing to the sustainability of the groundwater supply. So kind of a two-part question here. Kind of how is flood control contributing to the sustainability of groundwater? And second, is there another source of water other than the flood control that contributes to the supplies in your area?
Yeah, sure. Sure. So when we're we do partner with our local water agencies to try to promote the sustainability of our local groundwater basins. And as a matter of fact, right now we capture about 1,000 acre feet a year of stormwater runoff, and we put it in the ground to recharge those local aquifers. And so those local aquifers are underground banks of water that the local water agencies can use. They can pull the water out of those banks to basically serve to the local community. And so typically those banks are fed by just natural infiltration that occurs of rainwater runoff. Sometimes the water districts put imported water supplies into those underground aquifers. And then we try to supercharge additionally more water into those banks by capturing additional storm water and let it percolate into the ground and eventually into those basins. And so we meet with our local water agencies to identify where our facilities are, where the usable groundwater basins are, where there's opportunities to work together on projects, and then we try to pursue those projects. And so as I mentioned, we're doing about 1,000 acre feet a year of recharge right now, and we think over the long term that we can get up as high as maybe 8,000 acre feet a year as we continue to build more projects and partnerships with the local water agencies.
Can reply. So from a listener standpoint, I know that we're probably going to get some questions on this, Jason, but, you know, the difference between a storm drain and a sewer, right? I mean, you kind of just gave us a little bit of a view of that. What can you give us a little more specific answer to what the difference between the two are?
Sure. Maybe I'll let Richard take this one if he'd like.
All right.
Okay. Thank you, Jason. Sewers, or also referred to as sanitary sewers, are, as Jason indicated, designed to collect domestic sewage from within the home, water draining from baths, shower stalls, and toilets, as well as industrial wastewater for conveyance ultimately to a sewage treatment plant or publicly owned treatment works, where it is treated before discharge to a creek or river. Storm drains, by contrast, are designed to convey rainwater runoff, which, as we've mentioned, is also referred to as stormwater runoff, for conveyance directly to a creek, river, or lake. In Southern California, storm drains are entirely separate from the sanitary sewer system, and consequently stormwater discharges are for the most part untreated.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about last winter and the impacts of the Holly and Cranston fires on the local communities?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Last winter in July and August of 2018, actually coming into the winter, we had two very large fires in Riverside County. We had the Cranston fire, which burned about 13,000 acres in the San Jacinto Mountains, and then right on the back end of the Cranston fire, we had the Holly fire, which burned about 23,000 acres in the Santa Ana Mountains between the cities of Corona and Lake Elsinore. And so those fires combined burned about 40,000 acres. And unfortunately, the areas that burned hadn't burned for the better part of 70 years in some cases. And so we had very dense vegetation up on the mountains. We'd been in a drought, so the vegetation was very dry. And when the fire burned, it burned really hot. It burned really fast. And it really did a lot of damage to the mountainsides. And that was a major concern for us because there's actually about 40,000 residents who live combined below those two burned areas, with the most of the residents living below the Holly fire, and smaller communities, but no less important communities, living below and within the Cranston fire burn area. And so when you have these kind of burns and the vegetation gets burned off, and when you have these really hot fires, it also changes the chemistry of the soil. And so you have this layer of ash that's been burned, and then below that you end up with this waxy layer that basically prevents the rainwater from infiltrating into the mountain like it would normally. And so when it rains, the next time you get a significant rain on the mountain, not only do you get all the ash coming down, not only do you get all the burnt vegetation coming down, but all of the water comes down. And so you get a real magnification of rainfall runoff after a burn. And if you have rocks and boulders and other things in the watershed, you can get debris flows. And debris flows are kind of a form of a very fast-moving landslide, and they're incredibly dangerous. They can knock homes over. After the Holly fire, we had several teams of experts come in to analyze the mountain, and they were very nervous that burn area looked very similar to the burn the year before in Santa Barbara, the Montecito burn area. And so they were definitely concerned about the potential impact on the downstream communities. This was late August by the time that the burns were completed, and so we only had a couple months really to prepare. And so we had to determine where the risk areas were. We had to build mitigation where we could, identify areas where we needed to evacuate the community, educate the community, and then affect all that before the first storms occurred that winter. And so it was quite a challenging winter. And then, as you know, that was a very wet winter for us. And so the first storms that hit were late November. First major storm was November 29th. And then we were pretty much getting rain every 3 weeks after that. And so for the Holly Fire burn area, for the Cranston Fire burn area, we ended up with a total of, I think, 11 different evacuations that had to be affected to keep those communities safe.
I know you guys put a lot of time and effort in this stuff, but I also understand because of all that, you received some awards for your response to the Holy Fire. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. There was an incredible team of individuals and agencies that worked together to help keep the community protected. The majority of the effort was led by Bruce Barton at the Emergency Management Department, was led by the Sheriff's Department, the name is escaping me at the moment, but also it'll come back to me in a second. But Cal Fire, we had Chief Pemberton, Chief Ike, names are evading me. Sorry. But there was an incredible group of people here who were working on this, and part of what they were asking for from us was information that would help them to monitor the burn area so that they could vector their resources to critical problem areas during the rains, and also that they would be able to deconflict information in the emergency operations centers, because you get a lot of calls for a lot of people who don't really understand what they're seeing. They're very excited, they're very scared, and it's hard to translate what they're saying with reality sometimes. And so we helped to put together monitoring systems in the burn area that told us what rainfall were. We set cameras up that allowed us to view different portions of the burn area so we could actually monitor the debris flows if and when they were happening. We set up pressure sensors in the watershed to be able to determine when streams were flowing. And then we had to figure out how to get all that information from the mountain into our office and then back out to the people who actually needed to use it in a way that they could understand. And so we had about 2.5 months to figure that out, and our team did an incredible job of accomplishing that in a very short period of time. And so it was a recognized effort at a national level, at a state level, and the local level by organizations like the National Association of Counties, the California State Association of Counties, and American Society of Civil Engineers, and others.
Great. Oh, congratulations. I mean, that's a tremendous amount of accolades to have. You should be proud. I'm sure each one of these events is a learning process for you guys. So a little earlier you were speaking about infrastructure improvements and building dams and storm drains and levees and things like that. What other kind of major products have the Riverside County Flood Control District been pursuing or recently completed, for that matter? Can you kind of give us a rundown of those?
Yeah, I do. And actually, I wanted to step back because a couple names were evading me a second ago. And I did want to recognize Robert Novak with the Sheriff's Office and Chief Weiser with CAL FIRE as well for their assistance during the winter storms. But the district is pursuing a number of projects this year. And of course, we had to do several projects within the burn areas this last year. We had several debris basins. We actually enlarged those debris basins so they would have more storage capacity, so we were sure to protect our community. We had to build new debris basins to try to capture mud flow. We had a number of storm drains that collected rainwater runoff from the mountains. We had to go back and basically create debris-resistant inlets for those storm drains to make sure that they continued to function and they didn't plug and put water into our community. And so those were the projects that we were focused on that were just for the burn area. But then we have our broader mission as well that we started out intending to do and then got sidetracked from, to some extent by the emergency response. And so we do have a number of other projects that we've completed or we're working on now that we're very proud of. One is on the east side of March Air Reserve Base. It's called the Hecox Channel. And that's a mile-long channel that basically protects the eastern flank of the base. But it also removed about 150 homes and other structures from a FEMA-mapped floodplain. So there were portions of the community that used to flood. By the construction of this channel, we've been able to collect all that runoff and put it into a facility that now keeps those communities from flooding. And this was a particularly good project because it was actually a partnership between March Air Reserve Base, the March Joint Powers Authority, the city of Moreno Valley, and, of course, the Riverside County Flood Control and Water Conservation District. We have some – I'm sorry, did you have a question?
No, not me.
Oh, sure. Okay. Then we also have some other projects that we're working on of the interest. That one that we're doing in the city of Riverside, which is actually going to collect stormwater out of a channel, dry weather flows, and divert it to the sewer for treatment. And then eventually that treated water will then be put into a reclaimed water system for use back into the community. And so this is a way to try to capture, you know, even during dry weather when it's not raining, sometimes you'll see water in our channels. And that's usually water that's coming from over-irrigation or leaking irrigation systems or other non-natural sources of water that end up collecting in our system and then being wasted out into our some of the dry washes. And so now what we're doing in order to improve water quality is trying to collect some of that and then put it into the wastewater treatment system so that it can in turn be reused within the community.
Well, you guys do amazing things that hardly anybody knows about. They don't even realize all the things that you guys do. It's unbelievable to me.
Rob, this is Darcy, and we do one other major important accomplishment that we provide here countywide is we manage three municipal stormwater permits, and Richard Boone leads the division and a whole team of people in implementing those permits. I know Richard can explain a little bit more about the benefits of those and why we do those.
Okay. We'll get into that in a second. I was researching all kind of all of this. I've heard something entitled Community Rating System. And what is that, and how do the residents of Riverside County benefit from that?
Sure. So the Community Rating System is a FEMA program that's part of the National Flood Insurance Program. And so typically, if you buy a homeowner's insurance policy, you cannot... That policy does not cover flooding. And so if you have a standard homeowner's policy, your house floods, your homeowner's insurance isn't going to cover it. If you have an option through FEMA to buy flood insurance from the government, and for a long time that was the only way you could buy flood insurance. And so FEMA sets rates for the flood insurance, but they also have a program to try to encourage local agencies to implement floodplain management programs that exceed sort of minimum national standards. And if the local agencies implement those programs, the FEMA will actually give the residents a discount on their flood insurance policies. And so the community rating system is a way to score your implementation of floodplain management programs above and beyond federal minimums, and the higher level of implementation you have, the more of a discount that your residents will get on flood insurance for those who wish to purchase it.
So is it mandatory? If you live in a flood zone, is it mandatory that you have to do that? And I guess a follow-up to that is that the same as an earthquake insurance? I mean, I know it's a different policy, but I mean, is it the same kind of thing?
Yeah, I'll answer the first question. Is it mandatory? The answer is it depends. And so if you have a federally backed mortgage, as a mortgage from like Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, then under federal law, you're required to get flood insurance if you're in a FEMA mapped floodplain. If you don't have mortgage through a federally backed mortgage, or you have a mortgage through a non-federally backed lender, then flood insurance is not mandatory. It is in many ways exactly like earthquake insurance, where you have a choice as to whether you wish to pursue coverage or not.
Okay. Is that just a follow-up real quick? I know if you live in a earthquake zone and you go to buy or build a new house, they tell you that. Is it the same with the floodplain? The builder needs to know to inform the person buying the home that they're in a flood district?
Right. So typically if you're getting a federally backed mortgage, you're applying for a federally backed mortgage, your lender will investigate whether or not your property is impacted by a FEMA floodplain. And then if they determine that it is, I believe they will inform you that you must obtain flood insurance and maintain it in order to have that mortgage.
Jason, so let me ask another question here, because I'm kind of going back a little bit to what Darcy said earlier. And Darcy, feel free to chime in to give us a little bit more of a background on what you were talking about earlier, and invite Richard to the mic as well. Chime in on that.
Well, just a little bit going to what the flood control district does. There, you know, as Jason covered, we do a lot for emergency preparation, and we construct big things in the county. One of the other big things that we do, though, is in the Watershed Protection Division, and we manage the permits, the regulatory permits, for three different watersheds in our county, and that's Richard's job, is to make sure that we're in compliance, and we do that on behalf of the cities. There are 28 cities in the county. 27 of them fall under the jurisdiction of our permits, and the Coachella Valley Water District out in the desert, out in the eastern part of our county, as well as the county as a whole. So I know Richard can cover a little bit more of what we do, why it's important, and kind of what we do as managers of those permits.
Awesome. Richard, chime in there.
So I think the crux of what we do is we want the community to be mindful, and we want them to be protective both of our storm drain infrastructure and the stormwater, the water that flows through that infrastructure. Storm drains are a key element of the flood control infrastructure that has been constructed since the district's inception to protect county residents from flooding and flood damage. And being mindful and protective of those systems contributes directly to community safety, but as we sort of broaden our mission to think about how we can contribute to the region's water supply portfolio and also improve the quality of life for our residents by creating new recreational opportunities, being protective of these systems really helps everybody contribute to those very desirable community outcomes. And then stormwater. Stormwater is the water that sustains our creeks, rivers, and lakes, and replenishes our groundwater. By being mindful of that and by contributing to the protection of stormwater quality and really working and thinking about preventing water pollution, we are all, not just the district, but all of the county residents, collectively protecting our region's ecological resources. We're investing in recreational opportunities such as Lake Elsinore, and we're also directly protecting the aquifers and the groundwaters that are a key part of our region's water supply portfolio.
So from a standpoint, you know, just your explanation there, from a standpoint of being, you know, residents and homeowners here in Southern California, like most of us are, kind of puts a new emphasis on the term that you use, being mindful, that is, of all of these things, right? I mean, I don't think I've really been concerned about storm water and storm drains. You know, it's not something I get up every morning and go, oh, I wonder what's happening with the storm drains today, right? Kind of in your back of your mind. But people should be concerned about that and have an understanding, because it affects their lives, their quality, their recreation, and indeed their homes. Just a lot of stuff to be concerned with. So let me follow on with this question then. So, I mean, I think from a standpoint of hey, where does the water go, right, after it's been in the gutters and in the storm drains, and where does it go from there, Richard? Can you kind of give us a little scenario of how it makes its way to the ocean?
Yeah, even just before that, you know, watching the videos I saw from Channel 7 News on what's happening. What happens with all the dirt and all the things that it picks up and goes into those storm drains? Yeah, is there a system you have to monitor the waterways underneath the ground and see if it's you know, stuffed up with mud and debris, and how do you clean that out? Or I'm just curious.
Let me try and take the front part of that, then I'll turn it back to Richard. And I'm glad you brought that up, because the one of the main issues we had this winter, especially in the Holly and the Cranston fire burn areas, and even on February 14th, we had a major atmospheric river that dropped an immense amount of water, created basically a 200-year storm on two different mountain ranges. It actually activated a third burn, the Old Mountain burn, which was kind of over the Palm Springs area. But like I said, with no vegetation to hold the soil back, there's just immense amounts of mud and rock and soil that came down out of those mountains and into our channels and our storm drains. And so by the end of this winter, we actually ended up having to remove probably by the time we're done, we'll be up to over 60,000 dump truck loads of mud and rock and debris and vegetation.
From our facilities and channels. 60,000 dump trucks.
How do you get out? Because I'm sure your drains are long tunnels. How do you get it all out of there?
Well, and that was the key. And when I was speaking earlier, one of the things I kept mentioning was that we were trying to build debris-resistant inlets for our facilities.
Okay.
And so what we try to do is in the foothills of the mountains at the upper end of these facilities is stop that mud from ever having a chance to get into those underground channels. And so we can build debris-resistant structures and debris dams that basically stop the debris at the inlet, let the water continue on into the system, but generally prevent those systems from clogging. Now, I would tell you we were probably 85% effective with that. We definitely had some of our debris-resistant inlets that were overwhelmed. We did have a plugged storm drain, And so then you do have to get in there and clear that out with equipment like a vac truck. And so we did have to do some of that. But for the most part, we were able to keep the debris out of the underground systems where it's very difficult to remove and keep it into areas where we could better manage it. Now,
that's just mind-boggling when I think about it.
Yeah, it is quite an amount of work. And then we have maintenance programs. So we have staff here at the district that their job is to basically inspect all of our systems before the winter starts and then after the winter ends and even during the winter in some cases to make sure that those systems are functioning, they're not plugged. And so there's actually a proactive maintenance element that is in play even in a normal year, but in a year like we just had with the Holly and the Cranston fire, it's on supercharge, right? And because of the amount of material that was coming out of these mountains, we had contractors and maintenance crews that were basically working nearly 24-hour shifts for certain parts of the winter, trying to get that debris out of the way before the next storm came. And this winter, those storms were coming, this last winter, those storms were coming about every 3 weeks. And so it was a very long, tough winter for our team and our maintenance crews and the other public works agencies. And we're really proud of the work they're done. Now, the challenge is that these burn areas don't recover in 1 year. It'll typically take 3 to 5 years for the vegetation to grow back in to a point where the mountain will start acting like itself again.
Yeah, so you still have that same potential growth.
Right. Yeah. And so for the communities, what that means is we're not done. And so, you know, we did have mud coming through some of our communities. Some of the residents would get mud in their yards, and they'd have to push it out on the street, and the county would come, and the city would come pull it off the street. They had sandbags up last year. They're going to want to keep those sandbags out or refresh those sandbags this year because the mountain's not fully healed yet. We expect to see more mud. We expect to see more debris. And we're going to have to work almost as hard this year as we worked last year to continue to manage that until the mountain fully heals. And there's even a chance that this winter that we could have evacuations that affect some of these communities. Now, the mountain is healed. Last year we had to do evacuations if we had a half inch in an hour of rain predicted. This year the experts are telling us that we should move to 0.8 inches an hour for most of the areas, which means we should have less evacuations. But it doesn't mean that we won't have any evacuations. And there's also one community, the Glen Eden Sun Club, and there's a Korean church in this canyon called Indian Canyon in the Holy Fire Burn area that the experts continue to be very concerned about. And in that community, they're recommending an evacuation threshold of 0.65 inches an hour. So that community could be evacuated a little bit more frequently than some of the surrounding areas because of the specific risks of that canyon.
Yeah, Jason, so this is all predicated really on not having any more fires this year, right? I mean, we are in the middle of fire season and who knows what can happen, although I don't imagine there's a lot of fuel in those same areas where the Holly and Cranston fires were last year. Are plans in place or are there preventive measures in place in case there are additional wildfires this fire season?
Well, if there's additional wildfires, they'll have to defend against those the same as we did last year. There was a lot of light grasses that grew this last year. You know, it's just the start of the recovery of the vegetation. The real challenge, like you said, is that the burn area, most of the fuel is gone, right? So we're not going to get that same super hot fire like we got last year. But in Riverside County, we've had 4 additional burns this year, and these burns have been much smaller. But they may also cause risk to our communities that we're currently in the process of evaluating. And so there's the Sandalwood fire, there was the Tanaha fire, the Ritchie Canyon fire. You know, we have to look at all of those fires to determine what the risks are and to figure out appropriate mitigation strategies. And I talked a lot about mitigation, but the other thing I didn't talk about is with debris flows, they're very challenging to stop. And if you don't have the infrastructure in place ahead of when the fire happens, you're probably not going to be able to get it in place afterwards if you have a big canyon you're dealing with. And so a lot of times the only strategy that's available to local agencies is evacuation. And that's why we were evacuating up to 8,000 people, I think, typically out of the burn areas. And then on February 14th, the Valentine Day storm, which was 8 inches of rain over 12 hours and intensities of an inch of rain, about twice the threshold for that would cause or have the potential to cause a debris flow in terms of the rainfall intensities. We had something on the order of 60,000 residents that were either under evacuation orders or shelter-in-place orders. So,
yeah, let's take a look at the impact that the residents have, right, the homeowners in the area, the citizens in Riverside County. What can they do to help prevent stormwater and, for that matter, ocean pollution as well, because this stuff ends up, you know, down in the sea.
So yeah, so I'm gonna turn that one back over to Richard because that one kind of squarely plants in the programs that he runs.
So I'm just gonna, before we transition to stormwater pollution, I would just offer a literary footnote to the preceding discussion. There is a book, The Control of Nature, Los Angeles Against the Mountains, by John McPhee, written in 1989, which is almost required reading for anybody here at the district, but it talks about LA County's efforts to tame the debris flows that come out of the San Gabriel Mountains. And if anybody has any doubt about the fury that nature can unleash, particularly from a burn area, they should just take a time out, get a cup of decaf coffee and read Los Angeles Against the Mountains. But that's my literary recommendation for this radio cast. I'll get back to
a good one.
So back to the sort of the longer term conditions and our efforts to protect and improve and manage stormwater quality and our natural water resources here. I think when the question is posed, what can our residents, what can our citizens do? I think first and foremost, it's adopt the mindset that stormwater is a vital ecological, recreational, and drinking water resource. It's somewhat managed, as Darcy has said, in a permitting program that is part of a Clean Water Act mandate. And regrettably, it's managed from a regulatory standpoint, it's managed as a waste. But really, as I say, stormwater is a vital resource
and
for us.
And that mindset is changing a bit, Richard.
We're getting there.
We're getting there.
So
education is the best thing. So
yeah. So being protective of, once you've embraced that mindset, being protective of water quality, I mean, what specifically can you do? Well, our website is an excellent resource. We have plenty of guidance there, in particular best practices for pet care, for gardening, for how you go about protecting your home against bugs, car maintenance, swimming pool maintenance, and in particular disposal of household hazardous waste. All of those things can be done in a way that is protective of our critical water resources, but uninformed can also be done in a way that is highly damaging. I also note that Darcy and I are working on really on the cusp of launching a new education and outreach campaign really focused on best irrigation practices and the elimination of dry weather runoff.
Well, we'd love to help you any way you want to disseminate that information over the air with us. We'll do whatever you ask us to do. We'll be glad to help promote what you're doing.
Yeah, and we look forward to collaboration very, very definitely. And then I think just as a final note, also think we ask people to think about the storm drain system. By keeping our streets free of trash and debris, we really contribute to ensuring the proper functioning of this vital urban infrastructure, and we contribute very directly to the aesthetic appearance of our rivers and streams. I was out with 400 volunteers a week or two ago doing a cleanup of the Santa Ana River. And while you can be very encouraged about that level of citizenship and the concern for the river,
at the same time, you realize that that group of people could go out every weekend and almost every day and still find trash and debris to recover from the Santa Ana River, the mighty Santa Ana River that has given its name to three of the region's largest cities, Riverside, Santa Ana, and Anaheim.
I think they ought to put these little, I know when people take their dogs for a walk, they have these little dispensers of the plastic bags to pick up the poop. I think maybe you should put little bags all over the city so when people walk around the street, they see stuff, pick it up. Anyway, that's kind of crazy. But hey, I heard on another radio station the other day about this West Nile virus again. What does the district do to prevent that spread of West Nile virus?
So West Nile virus is spread by mosquitoes, and mosquitoes are tend to breed in still ponds of water. Mm-hmm. And so what the district does is we do monitor our facilities, and a lot of our facilities, some of our facilities are concrete, and they tend to flow better. Some of them are more earthen in nature and more natural, and they do have, the earth will move as the water flows over it and kind of recontours things. And so we do try to look for major ponding areas and try to make sure that they start flowing again. But we also partner with our local vector control districts, and the vector control districts work with us in areas as well. They'll go out and place mosquito fish or use other types of baits to basically manage mosquito populations. And so really it's a partnership between the two agencies to attack and address any problem areas that arise throughout the year. And if our residents are concerned about a potential mosquito breeding ground, then they should feel free to call us or call their vector control agency, and we will talk to each other and we will address it.
Excellent. Well, I'll tell you, I can speak for me, and I'll ask Chris here. I really learned a lot from listening to all you people, and that was quite amazing. I hope our listeners are much more informed. How do they get a hold of your agency? And you mentioned, Richard, the website and such. Can you give us the contact numbers and the website so people can go look at all of that?
Absolutely. So Watershed Protection is at www.rcwatershed.org. If you're looking for information more generally about the work of the district, including contact information about storm preparedness, reporting of clogged drains and flooding, you can look at www.rcflood.org. You can go to rivgoready.org to sign up for the Swift 911 app to be part of the county's emergency alert system. And then finally, I would note that myself and my staff are always available at the end of the phone. We welcome interest in our programs, and we can be reached via our main desk at 951-955-1200.
Excellent. I appreciate having all three of you on today. Chris, what do you say?
Jason Yulee, Dorothy Kanzi, and Richard Boone, thanks so much for all that information. You guys do a tremendous amount out there that a lot of people, as I was saying earlier, don't really think about every day. And congratulations for the awards that you got earlier for your work last year. Makes me feel safer as a resident of the county, and you're in Orange County behind the orange curtain there, Rob, but same applies for your end.
Absolutely.
I appreciate very much all of you being on our show today. Is there anything else that you want to add, either three of you, before we go off the air?
No, I would just add for those residents in the Holy and the Cranston Fire, the other burn areas, be sure to visit the rivcoready.org/stormready webpage to get updates and information on the status of the burns and activities and changes to evacuation zones. So
great. Well, thanks a lot for being on our show. We really appreciate it. Thanks for joining
Thank
the
you.
Water Zone.
Well, that was great. And, just for our listeners, don't forget to hear more episodes of The Water Zone. Be sure to download Turf's Up radio app and tune in every Saturday morning at 8 a.m. Central or 11 a.m. Eastern. Visit turfsupradio.com to learn more. You can catch us on